is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
It's time for the John DePietro Show here on News Talk, WNRI, 1380 AM and 99.9 and 95.1 FM.
He's a special kind.
DePietro, who is in the eye of the storm.
Suddenly, John DePietro became the story.
Radio talk show host, John DePietro.
All right, here we go, folks. The Power Hour has arrived. Good afternoon, all in one and all. All in one. John DePietro. We start at 11, we go till 2. It's AM 1380, 99.9 FM. This portion of our program, dinner or drinks in the lounge, stop by Kay's. A gift certificate from Kay's makes a great gift, a fantastic gift, as a matter of fact. But the staff there, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah from David and John and Jessica. And Faye behind the bar, they're just, they're the nicest people. And grab a delicious sandwich, and you have Danny in the kitchen. That makes a great gift, a gift certificate from Kay's, right across from CVS. Nicole and Kim, and of course Donna and Kathy and Jessica, they're just great. They're waiting for you. Always a friendly, nice vibe in here. Try the lobster roll or the pastrami. I love the roast turkey. They're waiting for you at Kay's. Well, folks, let's bring them on. He's the managing editor for Ocean State. Good afternoon to our friend Justin Katz. Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon, John. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Justin, I want to start off and get your thoughts on what I think it is interesting, Governor Raimondo, with these end-of-year interviews. And it's interesting. Sometimes people don't realize, or they're just going to go through the motions and just how much you're going to end of the year, Governor Raimondo did an interview, and I think it's good if they kind of feed off each other a little bit. We're also going to talk about the end of the year interview with the Senate President and the Speaker. But just your thoughts on end of year interviews from Governor Raimondo. Do you find her the way she's treating the new year coming in differently? Some of her goals, her mindset changed. What did you take away from some of her end of year interviews?
Well, I think perhaps the most striking thing I found is the pretense of, I mean, when she came in, there's a lot of feeling she'll be relatively conservative, or at least fiscally. She has the private assessment background, and I think that at this point feels like it's almost entirely out the window.
Yeah,
she's talking about, you know, we have a $200 million deficit and we have to do stuff that's not comfortable, by which she means find new ways to raise money and raise taxes. So that's kind of out the door, which is probably in keeping with an increasingly national focus on her part. Also, initiative TCI, the new gas tax that she's going to be pushing for, you know, just very openly saying we've got to have people get rid of their gas guzzlers. So, you know, almost overtly saying, yeah, we're coming after your cars. So there's a candor and a leftward swing that I've always suspected was underlying her political philosophy, but that's a change.
It's also surprising that one of her signature issues that she, you know, wanted to proclaim and trumpet a little bit was roadworks, and which was all about making the best, better roads and transportation, and then suddenly swings forward, and, you know, we have to get people out of these gas guzzler cars. I also find some of her comments, it's interesting sometimes you deal with people. Many times when I'll interview someone and they're running for office and they have these different proposals or ideas, and they, you know, I don't say it when I'm interviewing them, but you kind of afterwards I'll rehash with people, and you just, it's like they don't even know what they don't know, and it's so unrealistic. Or, you know, when you hear it and you get everybody in the same room together and blah, 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 and then none of it pans out. But some of her comments about electric trains and people in Rhode Island driving less and trying to justify this gas tax, I was almost struck. It was not someone who's been, basically was elected governor. The things she says to me are almost void of reality. Like, are we talking about the same state? Like, as if she no longer wants to deal with the realities on the ground. It's all just like pie in the sky things that, as you and I both know, the state, first of all, is still going through, you know, traffic reconstruction. Number 10 models are way out of whack. A big push she's had was trying to get faster trains to Boston so people could live in Rhode Island and work in Boston. But never before, ever, on the campaign trail did she ever talk about something about, you know, getting people out of their cars. I mean, that to me, that's new. That's a new one.
It kind of is. And, you know, the benefit we're going to get out of this is better public transportation. So, you know, she'll take away our cars, but, you know, you'll still be able to catch a bus down at the, you know, the park and ride or what have you to get around the state slowly. It is, as you say, it's not something she really ran on. I do kind of wonder, and of course the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity, but we started commenting on this about a week before the new TCI proposal came out as an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding. So I wonder if nobody was really expecting this to get much play, and then, you know, people like us started talking about it, so they had to come up with they didn't anticipate the questions. So her answer, I'm going to tell you the truth because I didn't prepare any talking points for this one. But people aren't going to give up their cars, and the idea that Rhode Island, with already high gas taxes, with a sluggish economy, with people who have a hard time getting by, the idea that you're going to impose new taxes on that group of people, whether it's the thing she wants to find for housing or whatever, the idea that you're going to continue to layer on these things, it's strange. I likened it to being, you know, the poor neighbor on the street. You know, all the neighbors are getting new cars and this and putting in pools or what have you, but you just don't have the money and you can't really entertain those ideas. And sometimes you got to tell the kids, no. I think our governor has a problem with that being right next to Massachusetts, where, you know, if Governor Baker wants to slow down his state's economy with some additional gas taxes, and keep in mind their gas tax is lower in Massachusetts than
yes.
Rhode Island already. If he wants to do that, you know, there's a little bit of play in their economy. They've got a lot of confidence in that. They still, you know, have a nation-leading school system, so does not. And that, as you say, she's devoid of reality in thinking, in not thinking in terms of the state that she actually governs.
Right.
And I think that probably relates also back to her national focus, where she has to say these things to get national attention, and she's not going to get national attention if she's saying, well, Rhode Island's economy is really in the dumps, and so I don't want to impose it. All those things are coming together.
Or just not geared for public transportation. It kind of is reminiscent to me, Justin Katz, of when, you know, Governor Chafee was saying, you know, I'm preaching. Her big thing was meds and eds. You know, we need to mirror Silicon Valley and Cambridge, Mass. And if you were really realistic and I would talk to business people, they would say, you know, we don't have the workforce that's ludicrous what Cambridge is doing, and that's what Silicon Valley is doing, and meds and eds, and you have to. There's that old thing that Don Rumsfeld said, which is you don't go to war with the army you want; you go to war with the army that you have. And a lot of that also is the same true of the workforce. You have different workers that would say to Chafee, you know, we're having problems filling these. The idea that a company could come in, we just don't have the workers for something like that. So to me, I think something else that I think sometimes the media gave her a free pass, and I think a big one was because, you know, I'm critical of the media. I can't do it all. I try to speak out in my forum that I have. But there was a major drug raid at Kennedy Plaza, and that had been going on. You're not talking one or two people. I mean, many people, and high scale and very extensive. And what no one ever stepped up and apologized for or addressed is that's a major communication hub. And I, you know, for so long would get email from people that would say, you know, how come the police don't go down there? And like, they had to put up with trying to exist in this huge open-air drug market. And you wouldn't have that in, you know, anyone that goes to Grand Central Station in New York. I mean, it's beautiful now. They have a food court. There's so much law enforcement, police. No one would describe Grand Central Terminal in New York City as an open-air drug market, and nor would they describe some of the things. Something that I took away from that big raid on Kennedy Plaza was how long has this been going on that people but had no choice, that were trying to do the right thing and either take public transportation or they just, that's the way they get around, and they had to put up with vagrants. And again, there were like 25 people arrested, looked, you know, really rough and tumble. No one ever thought that's one of the quality of life, that if I was one of those individuals, I wouldn't want to have to commute through there every day.
Well, I think it goes right to the idea that nobody ever thought of it. It goes right to the perspective that our state government brings to these questions of economic development and policy. We're going to bring in this industry because it's hot. And people say, well, we don't have the workforce. Well, the answer you got from, certainly from the Chafee administration and also somewhat from the Raimondo administration is, in essence, we'll change our population. Whether we're going to be attractive to the cool, hip people and where they're going to move here, or we're going to re-educate our own population to be in. The focus is always on changing the people, not crafting your economy around the people you actually have and what they might want to do with their lives. And I think that goes, that's very similar to the idea of we're going, well, government, we can't crack down on the druggies right now. We've got other priorities. Well, you know, maybe you wouldn't if you were focused on who's here right now, who's their quality, how can we improve our constituency's quality of life? Rhode Island politicians aren't great at looking at that. They're great at, you know, giving away to special interests who get their attention for one way or another and for coming up with these grand schemes that, you know, often are imported from the state, from the national level through Brookings Institution or something like that, but really affecting people broadly here. And how can we fix it? And the reason is because the fixes are pretty mundane. You know, get government out of the way, do some basic things like keeping the streets clean and everything, you know, well run. And we're just not good at that. And we saw it, as you said, we'll be talking about the Senate President and House Speaker's interviews, and he's poorly managed, and
yes,
we correct on that.
Yeah, and let's touch on each of them, and then I do want to touch on the situation that took place in Warwick and then also in the Rhode Island veteran home situation in Bristol. Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. Starting with the Senate president, he said a couple of things. I was surprised he didn't get a little more blowback. He had a yellow. I thought they were pretty realistic, pretty earnest. I don't think they pulled punches with their, quote, end of year interviews, but starting with Ruggiero, who came right out and said, no, we're not doing marijuana. But the comment that I'm surprised he didn't get more flack on, Justin Katz, was he kind of came out and said, boy, the kids are barely learning now, let alone if we bring more pot into the situation. You think there is a problem with learning. There is a problem with the education. A lot of the kids are, you know, they can't even do the work at CCRI. And now he's looking at as if, and now you just want to have marijuana everywhere. What were your thoughts on? I mean, he was pretty clear that he's in complete opposition to it.
Well, of those three, the most surprising to me, mainly because in recent sessions he seems to have been moving left and being much more in sync with the sort of the progressive group, growing progressive group in the General Assembly, much more so than Mattiello, certainly. Some of those hot button issues, like the marijuana, and also he's a big union guy, and so to say the kids, to some respects, in the face of the teachers union,
right?
So it was almost another instance of refreshing honesty. It seemed like,
yeah, as they call a political gaffe. Every
yeah,
time
exactly.
Someone tells the truth.
Yeah, exactly. He admitted that the kids are barely learning. So, in some regards, he returned to my impression of him when he was majority leader in the Senate back under Paiva Weed's presidency. Just because he's always had that, given that impression of the traditionalist kind of more conservative Democrat type on these kind of issues. And it was starting to wane. You know, in the past couple of years, he made a lot more buzz, a bit more of the identity politics stuff and equal pay and all that. And so you started to have questions about whether he wasn't quite as conservative as we thought. So this interview, I mean, he certainly wasn't as conservative vocally as Mattiello, but certainly reverted back to what I had thought of him prior. And I think he made good points on a lot of what he had said.
He did, and I'm on the marijuana thing, because when I see something like that, I remember years ago someone, when it came to politics, when someone sometimes, they either come out lukewarm on something, they either come out against something, or the classic is they're not sure. This person told me an example, you know, you go way back when there was almost like openly a lot of pay to play, and let's just say a record was released. And so the record company is trying to get all the radio stations to play it. So you have two radio stations. And the first program director, he says, well, I think it's a great record. He puts it on right away, and it's so hot, they're playing it every hour. The other program director says, yeah, I'm not sure about that record. I don't know just yet. So the record company, you know, a microwave. And then they give him some gift certificates. And then they give him two tickets to Miami. And then they promise them, we're going to fly you to a concert. And then the record, the program director says, okay, now I'll play the record. And the lesson is, there's really nothing to be gained if you come out of the box right away and say, I'm going to play it. Now, it's supposed to say, I like that sound, my listeners would like it, and you're going to play it. But then in reality, it starts to become a business of, like, what's in it for me? What I have heard is something to watch is, they don't like the fact that Governor Mundo is suing this whole business that they want a lottery done for who's going to get the distributorships and so forth. And there's just a lot of games. Hello. Boy, really in opposition. Providence Journal editorial today completely praising Mattiello. And boy, Ed Acorn even used a bazooka on his Twitter feed, which I was kind of surprised, because a lot of people would say, like, isn't that a little extreme, showing a bazooka shooting something out of the sky? But the Journal is not even hiding the fact that Mattiello is trying to hold the line. It's just completely flipped.
Oh, certainly. I mean, a lot of his conversation, the statements he made were statements you or I might make about, you know, we've been cutting taxes and now's not the time to reverse that. And there's so much fat here we could trim, and, you know, $200 million out of the Executive Office of Health and Human Services alone. And I mean, just that sort of progressives was very conservative, even for Mattiello, I thought. Again, reverting kind of what was expected before he got in office, and a lot of us have been more hesitant in recent times. But, you know, all of us should be qualified with the reality that these are single interviews at the end of the year, just also for, as you say, the payola angle, where they might be angling for something. But both of them together were, Ruggiero and Mattiello were very critical that the state doesn't manage things well. We don't regulate well. We don't do things well, which, you know, to some extent, they have a responsibility for that. They're not setting forth the policy and insisting on it being followed. But who's very conservative, especially for a newspaper guy. I could see why he would in particular be fond of the statements that Mattiello made.
Yeah, not only that, and Mattiello, when he talks about mismanagement and you can find money there and so forth, Justin, that is not the talk you ever hear. I mean, anytime people in order and others that try to talk about, like, cutting, you know, up at the State House, it's all, there's nowhere to cut and blah, blah, blah. And boy, there's the speaker saying, well, there's a lot of fat and things are mismanaged. And if you want to rein it in, the question is not more taxes. You just need to run things more efficiently. And that's a complete shot at Raimondo. And I also, I don't think he's.
Yeah, probably not. But as you say, he some of the greatest hits in this, like the idea that we have to fix the structural problems, and if we don't do that, then we can raise taxes all we want. We'll just be coming back for more in a few years. I mean, it makes you think he's certainly got his close race, a very conservative Republican in Rhode Island, coming into an election year. That the cynical angle is that he knows what rhetoric he needs for his own district, and he's going to go after that, which is sort of how the system's supposed to work. So that's encouraging. And also, similarly, in his and others have said, it's a little bit of a dodge, but avoiding the commentary on impeachment of President Trump. And he said, that's not my lane. I'm focusing on local stuff. And so I think there's a conspicuous and deliberate contrast here between the more progressive angle of the governor and the more national focus of the governor, whereas you've got a more conservative angle, particularly Mattiello, and particularly emphasizing we are focused on Rhode Island and our own unique problems here. And I think it speaks to the different, well, obviously the governor's term limited anyway, but it speaks to the different political calculations. When you're in a race of a few thousand votes that can be swung by a couple hundred, you better be focused more on the people who actually vote for you than folks down in Washington who might be laying some tracks for you to get into a future administration.
Hey, folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. I want to just mention, I'm just seeing this on Twitter. The New York Times is reporting Tom Brady signs 2-year contract extension. Again, this is $5 million through the 2021 season when he'll be 44. So details are still coming out, but I believe the New York Times are the first one to reporting that. And that is really substantial and I think in almost some ways surprising. Brady has signed a 2-year contract extension. We'll have to try to get more details. Justin, I want to swing over to the situation that happened in Warwick. I think it's confusing to some people, and there was a lot of buildup to this contract. What people should know is a lot of times people, what happens in one city or town, one of the problems when you have everybody has their own contracts is a lot of times what they're looking to do is if Warwick gets something, then Providence and Cranston, they try to get it put in as well. And then if Pawtucket gets it, then Woonsocket and Providence and Cranston. And so they all use, a lot of people could say, well, it doesn't matter. I don't live in Warwick. It can have other, you know, kind of effects in some way regurgitated around the state with other contracts. But this situation where the mayor and certain people were trying to rush through a firefighter contract, by the way, it's never been resolved that Warwick City Hall was even admitted a side deal with the Warwick firefighters and so forth. That still remains unresolved. But it is frightening that in 2019 that this thing is still going on, that they're trying to rush through a contract that has not been properly vetted. And it even went to, I mean, Friday night at 5 o'clock. It took people showing up to call a halt to this. Out to be a disaster in the second largest city.
Well, the Friday night, right before Christmas, emergency contract meeting is definitely a red flag. I think the biggest lesson in all of this is the complete lack of trust they have over there in Warwick. And what so all of this not seeing the big problem they have. I mean, this could be a fantastic contract. It could be the worst contract ever or anything in between. But nobody's going to believe any of it or have any trust in any of it because of the way the sides have been drawn and the trust is gone, which I think it was Ken Block said directly, you have to be very skeptical of this because you've done it for years. Once you hit that point, your problems are no longer, you know, what's fair at the negotiating table, what town is going to get what idea from this, or who's going to benefit politically. Those questions start to go out the window because you can't operate without some basic trust on the facts and how the that to me indicates there's a much bigger problem in Warwick that nobody's even at this point addressing. Are trying to figure out how to address that level of just skepticism going both ways, but justifiably skepticism of the government and particularly its operations with this particular union.
Yeah, and on top of that, the way I understand it, and Ken Block was saying that there were certain parts of the contract that were left dissolved. There's still an investigation going on, and for the mayor and those people just try to ram it through. It is... Boy, it is still to me like the inmates running the asylum, and they were trying to, you know, this is what is also so sad. And again, folks, good afternoon. It's Sean DePietro speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor of OceanStateCurrent.com. But they were trying to open the fact that they made the contract available for people to see before it was going to be voted on and signed. In their mind, like, that's how broken it is that someone deserves credit. They think you deserve credit for that. It's just like that is absurd. And then it never should have been a system where you can't even see it until it's voted upon and then agreed upon. And they were looking for, you know, and I heard different people, I give them credit, they made it transparent and let people see the contract before it was signed off and pushed through. That is like a complete broken system.
Yeah, why is that even a question? Exactly. And, the Senate of the special meeting at work, you know, somebody came and served a notice while he was with a client. The way they're behaving is, I mean, I don't, I don't know why they would be so. I mean, the excuses that the faction is giving is that they want to make sure they don't have a backlog at the next meeting. But how they could fail to see how all of this would come across Friday night before Christmas, it boggles the mind. I think it goes back to just not considering the other side's actual opinions and how things appear to them. I mean, if I read correctly, they lost their city solicitor because of the way this has been handling. So it seems like Solomon and his ally, they must not know what they're doing. I mean, they're not handling it well as a matter of politics or policy, let alone, I mean, even putting the contract aside. And that doesn't bode well. And what it really calls for is some kind of leadership in the city, to somebody to come forward with an idea of how to get past tone deafness, which I think is a legacy, I think, of a long time of single mayoralship with a lot of stuff going on that we didn't find out about until Avedisian had left.
Yeah, I think. Do you think it's a matter of? do you think it's a matter of that they and then this week people aren't paying attention because it's Christmas, and then next week they're not paying attention because it's New Year's, and then people just come back and it's already just a done deal?
Well, that's very plausibly what they were going for, but to think that they could is where a lot of the tone deafness comes in. I mean, you've got Rob Cody, who's been for years. In recent years, they've had Ken Block making a show of it, and he's known around the state. He can get traction when he wants to on an issue. And for them to think, oh, this will just, we'll slip this through, I think there's really a misunderstanding of how politics works. And Warwick hasn't been, you know, I haven't followed it at the local level extremely closely. It does seem a bit like Avedisian worked a lot of deals, had things feeling like they were running smoothly, and I'm not going to opine on whether he did or not. But then when he's gone, suddenly they it's almost like they just don't have that practice of the debates and the fights and the, you know what I mean? Like, you get a Steve Laffy in Cranston, and at Jenna, they understand how it works and how you do the give and take with an opposition. And it's almost like Warwick doesn't necessarily have that anymore. And in that regard, I think they're pretty representative of the state as a whole.
Yes. No, I would agree with that. Folks, good afternoon. It's John DePietro. Speak with Justin Katz, managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. Justin, something else that is, you know, I think it's going to get more attention, and I think it's still kind of come out. And it has to do with the Veterans Home in Bristol. I don't think a proper analysis has been really done with the numbers. I still haven't heard or learned who designed it, who signed off on the design, who negotiated the contract. To me, though I was from someone I talked to, that this was a gift to labor. you know, Raimondo gave it to them. You know, kind of like thank you for the support during the election. They built the homes way bigger than they even needed to be. I think it's three times larger than what the other one was. The old Veterans Home in Bristol had one kitchen. No one bothers to see that when they say seven kitchens, if you just have something the size of someone's normal kitchen, you have a dining room, but then you have like a, they call it a kitchen, but if you have that, under the contract, that needs to be staffed with people. So it's a way to put more jobs in there. You don't need seven kitchens. No one was paying attention when this thing was A, constructed, and then B, who ultimately what was in charge on signing off on these contracts? Now, you know, is it Department of Administration? Because then DBA's left, and so now Smiley can just come in and say, hey, I wasn't here when this was done. But when you hear some of the number cleaning contract, immediately boom, a drop of a hat, they able to knock it down 25,000. You know, how much is going into this thing that you can get them to, you know, you can save almost 100,000 like in a blink of an eye. But between and then I also saw they have 20 full-time people. 20 people that are out on, you know, they have to get a certain thing. So then you're paying the people that are out. It just seems to be what I would call the classic. It's a state operation, so it's gouged. It's time and a half. It's as many staff people as possible. not to go on 2 years and more than 10 years ago, I was doing an Ask the Governor with Governor Kacheri. And he couldn't believe what was going on at the registry and how much it cost and there'd be lines. And so one day he said he wanted to go and like kind of do a walk around, you know, unannounced, like what exactly is going on. And then he saw that, you know, there were two lines. There was one line with 50 people in it. And he said, how come that woman can't take some of the? Oh, no, she's a licensed specialist. That line is just for the car registrations. And then he saw someone else and said, well, what do they do? Oh, no, they're that type of specialist. And under the union contract, that's all you did. You couldn't do the other stuff. And by the licensed specialist, even though anyone could do anything, if you called in sick, they had to get another licensed specialist to come in to work for you, and that was time and a half. And the way he kind of explained it to me was, when I was in high school, I worked in a grocery store, right? So people are coming out, and they put everything through line. And he kind of explained it like, can you imagine if you had next to you, they only ring up dairy, and then the next cashier, they just ring up regular grocery. Well, you know, you'd have far more cashiers than you need, and you would have longer lines, and you just create more workers. I think the same type of thing is going on at this veterans home.
Yeah, to be that way. And what makes it worse, I mean, the DMVs have been a kind of a bugaboo from the public perspective for decades, as you know, the place you go for bureaucratic pain, right, to sit in line forever and get a stamp here and have to move over there. And but the challenge with something like the veterans home is if you look at the local, people are very quick to say, well, just supply them with more money, because it is, we want to help the veterans. And one of the proposals is that they would start going after the estates of them if they die without a will. We just have a kind of an aversion to that kind of idea, or taking food away from visiting family, your family member in this veterans hospital. Those sorts of things we rightly have an aversion to, and so it's easy to lose track of the things you're talking about with all the size of it, the number of kitchens, and it really, to me, the big flapping red flag here is the idea of any idea of having government. This right at the top of your list for why not to do that, because the consideration,
right,
to stop being a patient, stop being how to operate, and start being, well, how do we give special deals to this union or that union? And I, you know, like, they didn't mention it in their interviews, but this is, I think it goes directly to, as we were saying earlier with Speaker Mattiello and Senate President Ruggiero, it's poorly and does not have a good track record. And I do kind of wonder if maybe it's getting through to some of our state politicians that people are noticing, and that's a lot of the skepticism you're having. You know, we still hear about, you know, 38 studios and, you know, the government insiders saying, oh, well, let's let that be in the past and we'll move forward with the next thing. But that's not it. It's everything. It's DCYF, it's the DMV, it's this veterans home. The state government just that's a big, big problem. But I agree, there've got to be things that can be trimmed as far as personnel and the facility in Bristol without affecting services at all. And that's becoming a theme around here now.
Yeah, that is exactly right. You know, it's interesting. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, when them talk about it, all you have to do is look at the why. There's so many problems with the VA. There's so many problems with the Veterans Association. And people need to recognize that the problems that people run into in the, you know, anything that is government run, DMV, whatever, that can you very, very ill or dying, and then, you know, something like that, like this, like dealing with this type of bureaucracy. I don't know exactly what happened. I think now the point about them going after their estates, that would be if they had no family alive. So then they have people that are passing away, they don't have any family. So then the state getting inside the veterans home, but nonetheless, they have, you know, a general there trying to work it out. They have the military people there. What some people don't understand, and it's kind of comical, is what they, you know, I someone sent me an email saying, I think, you know, a group of veterans would like to go and volunteer and clean up and do this type of thing. I'm sorry that some people are naive, but people that were neighborhood volunteers learned this with the Providence schools. People come in this and say, you know, we're going to get a group of parents and volunteers. We're going to go up and clean the school. Well, the only problem is the union people that have that contract saying, you know, you're not stepping foot in there. You're not going to clean anything. You're not doing anything like that. There's so much bureaucracy. You want to go over there and help out and things like that. This the same reason why... you know, the highways look the way they do, and you don't have more of that stuff, is because the unions step in and say, we're not going to have you interfere with union jobs.
Yeah, in fact, at the Veterans Hospital, there was a group that was planning to try to get food trucks to volunteer to go there to provide food for this little and so on, and it didn't get off the ground. Because, no, you can't do that. We have a food services contract. We're just dictating what terms people can eat under now. And if you want to help, I mean... The first problem is when you step up to try to volunteer and help, you're really just creating more flexibility in their budget to be able to give money away to the special interests. But even then, you just can't do it. As you say, it's a job program. Really, they're just creating new ways, and it's a very well established. We spoke earlier about firefighters. The fire unions do it one town to the next. All of the unions that are municipal do the same kind of thing. They try to leapfrog, and it's very deliberate. It's very, you know, let's put an extra kitchen in contract. It looks benign, right? Anybody reading a union contract would say, oh, well, of course, if you have a kitchen, you need somebody, you know, who can operate it in there. But what they're not considering is maybe they added a kitchen just to create that job, which is...
Oh, yeah.
It's very difficult to overcome, and you could see why we get something like, you know, such deep apathy in Rhode Island. And this, because once you get to this point of depriving visiting families of a little bit of food or just what have you, once you get to that point, it's very easy to just throw up your hands and say, you know what, this just isn't solvable, and it isn't with the current willpower in state government.
And it's also, it would be definition of a kitchen. That also comes in microwave and a refrigerator. That's considered a kitchen. And then, so therefore, you have to have full-time staff that are manning that. So you end up with two people sitting in a room, probably the size of just a regular first person's dining room, sitting there playing on their phone, reading magazines, but they're, quote, that's part of one of the, quote, kitchens that then has to be staffed by this. So, but I also, this is another example to me of, you know, whether it was a campaign promise that Raimondo did and let this thing get out of hand. No wonder she wants to make an exit and go on the national front and get involved in the national campaign, because to me, this is another example that, boy, her and her staff either incompetent, but this is another example where they drop the ball, something that should be celebrated, brand new veterans home, and then how do you screw that up? Because then it's way over budget, and it was built too big, which you didn't need to. Boy, they love to build big things, don't they? They love to build a big train station garage. You know, that was a gift to Labor. I heard the construction cost on this veterans home was like 25-30% over what it should have been. But again, you know, the unions, then they get that. It's a no-bid deal. It's a public, those types of deals that are done. Same thing when they build like a state building and things like that. The people that built the Wexford Garage, they love to, there's no money in just building something affordable. Do the mega project. There's so much more space. But then, you know, no one is saying that this is over cramped or anything. They just talk about how much it costs to clean, how much that's over. But something that stood out at me is when you have that many people that are out, full-time, they're out sick full-time, 20 people. I mean, all of those people coming in then are then getting, you know, time and a half. They find new ways to just gouge the system.
Yeah, well, it's like a few years ago when the Center for Food and Prosperity, we researched, and we started by looking into everybody who was making six figures in state government. We were finding laundry workers making $120,000, $130,000 a year, working overtime, which possible to work that much overtime, but all the rules and nurses do get this too. You know, if you work overtime, but you're technically supervisor on two floors, you get paid the overtime for both floors at the same time. All these rules that just compound. And the idea of needing people for the kitchen, it makes me think of, as particularly we mentioned before, Governor Raimondo wants to use money. She wants to take our cars but give us tech, public transportation. Well, we've got this self-driving vehicle now, the bus or our car in Providence, but they pay somebody. It doesn't need a driver, but it does have somebody who sits there and sort of watches the car do its thing and, you know, greets riders, I guess, and can take over if something goes wrong. But it's just so perfect. You know, well, we're going to have a kitchen with a microwave, and we need somebody to supervise that, maybe wipe it down every now and then or something like that, time and a half and overtime, because everybody's... It does get you to throw your hands up and really wonder how there's not a something close to a political revolution in the state.
Yeah, well, it's reminiscent of, to me, the scene in Goodfellas when they take over the restaurant and they're bringing the money, you know, the booze and the stuff into the front, and then they're bringing it out the back. And when nothing's left, they then, you know, just torch the place. It's, you know, you screwed up, you trusted us. I mean, it just seems to be another example. I also just want to issue a correction. As I was talking to Justin, I was flipping through Twitter, because then sometimes I want to make sure I'm not missing anything, and I fell for one of those fake stories. Tom Brady does not have a new contract. I apologize. When you click on it, it's an old New York Times story from August, but there's someone that the contract he wanted, and they fell for it. So I apologize. This hasn't happened to me before, and I shouldn't have done it live on the air, but there is no deal. The contract, the story that people were referring to was from the New York Times, but it was from August when he did sign the New Year deal. But the way it was presented on Twitter seemed like he just signed a brand new deal that would keep him here in New England. That is not the case. Justin, great job. Merry Christmas, and we'll talk to you again very, very soon.
Yeah, Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah to all your listeners as well.
All right, folks, there he is. Justin Kath, managing editor, OceanStateCurrent.com.